This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place, whether you're in the mood for a cinematic extravaganza, an epic concert performance, or a bold stage musical with a touch of humor. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Hooray for Hollywood South, that is. Actors, producers, elaborate parties, and of course a bevy of new films are in the mix as the New Orleans Film Society kicks off its 28th annual New Orleans Film Fest this week. Fallon Young is the new executive director. She's here. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thank you so much.
Was this a baptism by fire taking on the film fest?
You know, it certainly is a huge endeavor. The past few years, we've had 20 to 25,000 people at the film festival and over 200 films and 400 filmmakers in the mix. And we're a nonprofit with a very small team. So we fight above our weight a little bit to produce a film festival on a grand scale.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and your vision for the New Orleans Film Fest.
I am a longtime arts lover and a film lover as well. And my background is working in arts and cultural nonprofits, specifically nonprofits that present art that deal with identity-based issues and social justice-based issues. So I feel really passionately about giving artists a platform. So it was a wonderful opportunity for me to join the New Orleans Film Society.
Are you a New Orleanian?
I am not a New Orleanian. I grew up in East Texas, and my family is from Eunice, Louisiana, if you know where that is.
Yes, I do. Southwest Louisiana.
Yes.
You have some high-profile talent and some special conversations on the bill this year. What will we experience?
Our 28th annual New Orleans Film Festival features the most diverse lineup in the organization's history. This year, 54% of films are by women filmmakers and 45% by filmmakers of color. Opening night is the Florida Project, so we kick off the festival with a grand opening at the Orpheum Theater. The Florida Project is a film by Sean Baker.
The man who lives in here gets arrested a lot. These are the rooms we're not supposed to go in. But let's go anyway!
A very charming film, a look at childhood. Also, the underside of that film deals with issues of hidden homelessness and the American dream. It takes place in a hotel just across from Disneyland and presents a very different reality than maybe a Disney reality would indicate. That's how we kick off the festival, with a producer in attendance, but we also have some amazing conversations with Academy Award nominated actresses Patricia Clarkson and Gabby Sidibe. On Saturday night of the festival, we present our centerpiece film, which is Mudbound. This film was shot in Louisiana, headed for Oscar season. And in attendance will actually be an actor who played Eazy-E in Straight Outta Compton. His name is Jason Mitchell, and he's from the Holly Grove neighborhood of New Orleans. And he is in attendance to receive a Trailblazer Award for this film, Mudbound.
I see Marshall is on your list.
Yes, Marshall is an incredible film starring Chadwick Boseman as the young Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, prior to him being Supreme Court Justice.
Baby, you go into these towns, I've never seen a Negro lawyer.
Hey, boy!
You need to be careful.
NAACP.
Very good. You're going to Connecticut.
Joseph Spell, Negro servant, tax socialite in our own bedroom.
This case will show the world if a colored man can get a fair trial in the United States.
There's only 13 million Negroes depending on you.
Don't any of you have any confidence in me?
I'd say you have enough confidence for us all.
The Darkest Hour stars Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill. The Upside is based on a true story and remake of the critically acclaimed French film L'Intouchables. And it chronicles the friendship between a character played by Bryan Cranston, a Park Avenue billionaire left paralyzed after his hang gliding accident, and an ex-con played by Kevin Hart and their relationship. Last Flag Flying also is an incredible film. It's directed by Richard Linklater. 30 years after serving in Vietnam, a former Navy corpsman, Steve Carell, reunites with his old military buddies, again, Bryan Cranston and Lawrence Fishburne, to bury his son, a young Marine killed in the Iraq War.
How many films are being screened?
230-plus films this year are being screened in the New Orleans Film Festival.
Wow. How were they chosen?
We received over 5,000 submissions, and our programming team watched each film 3 times. So quite an intensive process, and selected the top 230 films. The curatorial team really looks for diverse voices, emerging voices, and views the festival as an opportunity to discover films that the audiences might not otherwise see or might not find their platform without a festival like this. Some of the highlights this year in terms of diverse filmmaking are Our 100 Days, which is a shorts program that's curated through a collaboration between Firelight Media and Field of Vision, and the collection explores threats to U.S. democracy and its most vulnerable communities in the current highly polarized political state. So it's a collection of films by filmmakers of color that look at racial equity. We also have films that address activist legacies, particularly Norlinian activist legacies. There's a film called Acorn and the Firestorm, as well as a film about Wade Rathke, who is a key organizer and founder of Acorn.
How many Louisiana-based filmmakers are represented?
There are more than 60 films that are made in Louisiana.
And I hear there are parties every night?
Oh, yes. Movie Maker Magazine this year named New Orleans Film Festival one of the top 25 coolest film festivals in the world, and specifically mentioned that we set the bar for parties among U.S. film festivals. So on Saturday night, we are presenting the world premiere of Tropical Punch at a party. This is a documentary featuring the Queen Diva herself, Big Frida. It's the kickoff of a visual album by Big Frida. It's almost like a mini doc about the history of bounce music leading into tunes by Big Frida. We have a wonderful event on Tuesday night in the parlor, which is behind the Pontchartrain Hotel, with food from the Caribbean Room. Friday night of the festival, we are in the Juan Bon Mansion at the edge of the French Quarter, which is a 3-story mansion with music by Mashiach Lake. Some of our parties feature local musicians like Bon Bon Vivant, so it should be a great time to mix and mingle with Hollywood South.
New Orleans Film Society Executive Director Fallon Young, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks so much.
Whoa. Let's go, come on.
Have a nice day.
Love you, Bobby.
I love you, too.
The New Orleans Film Fest runs October 11th through 19th in venues across the city. More info and a schedule of events is online at neworleansfilmsociety.org. Critically acclaimed composer and trumpeter Wadada Leo Smith is heading to New Orleans, one stop on a 4-city tour for the southern premiere of his epic civil rights tribute, 10 Freedom Summers. The legendary musician pays homage to civil rights icons in a groundbreaking work for which he was a finalist for the 2013 Pulitzer Prize in Music. Wadada Leo Smith joins us by phone. Hello.
Hello.
It's exciting that you are making a tour stop in New Orleans.
I'm so excited about New Orleans. It's happening.
This is a work that's been your life's passion. What was the inspiration for 10 Freedom Summers?
That it would provoke a dialogue about the civil rights movement, which everyone knows is not over, and there's question as to whether it would ever be over. Those are the kinds of reflections that I was making to go into this job of creating this music about the struggle of liberty, rights, justice.
This has been a work that took decades to complete, beginning back in 1977. Tell us about your journey and what you set out to achieve.
The first piece was Mega Everett's, because he had been assassinated in Mississippi. I was asked by Leroy Jenkins to write a piece for his new ensemble. This is in 1977. The new ensemble had Anthony Davis and Andrew Sorrell and Leroy Jenkins on violin. And so I wrote this Meg Evers piece, and that was the very first one. They did a premiere in Italy. I heard the piece live for the first time. And over the years, I've kind of reflected and said, well, maybe I should add something here and there. So I wrote pieces not intending in the beginning that it should be a collection. Right now, it's 24 pieces. In 2000, I decided that this was probably going to be something because I was commissioned by the University of Georgia to write a piece, of which I wrote about the Freedom Riders. And so at that point now, I'm thinking that maybe I should kind of look at this and see what I will do with it. And I started to write, say, the last 5 years before the premiere. I got the Guggenheim Foundation, Chamber Music of America, various funding and granting sources supported them. And so I wrote them and just kept writing until I got a chance to have a performance.
And what is it that ties the works together in this song cycle?
1954 was the Brown vs. Board of Education. 1964 was the signing of the Civil Rights Bill. If we look back at a decade of pursuing a single idea, which is the idea of liberty, and not to have it happen, that's the underlying stroke of it. The impact that this movement has had on America and what it needs to actually bring about substantial change.
You are performing works from the third collection of 10 Freedom Summers while in New Orleans. What's being explored in that particular section, and what will we experience?
Well, I hope that it will provoke the audience to question their position in this society about rights and privileges. Some of the pieces that are happening is called In the Diaspora, Earthquake and Sunrise Missions, America Part 1, 2, and 3, The Little Rock Nine, The March on Washington, D.C., Fannie Lou Hammer, September 11, that Sunday morning when those four young girls were blown up in Alabama, and a new piece that's called Johnny Diani Mbizo, who is a South African bassist who was intimately involved in trying to rid apartheid out of his country. Also, Angela Davis will be in this performance.
And I understand that this is both a musical event and a multimedia project. How so?
Many people were not around during that decade, 1954 to 1954. We wish to bring those images back, project live, moving, interactive energy from the stage of the performance, mixed with what is happening in the music, because it creates and causes to happen something different on the screen than just what was projected.
Now tell us a little bit about yourself. You were born in the segregated South in the 1940s in Mississippi.
That's correct. In the Delta, very powerful place, a very dangerous place, full of intrigue with life and beauty, but it also has this other element, oppression. And because I grew up in a segregated South, the oppression was shared collectively.
You're labeled as a jazz composer, but it is not a title that you prefer.
We don't really call it jazz, and we don't even use the word improvisation anymore. The reason we don't call it jazz, because jazz is just like every other law that inhibits what we can do and how we can do it. It's not a cultural term that has satisfied any artist that I've ever met, including Duke Ellington, and I met him, okay? So we call it creative music, which is has something to do with the way in which it's made. We dropped the word improvisation because that was never a word that was used by the early performers and artists. That was something implied upon them. We used the word create and the word creation, which more correctly define the type of activity that's taking place. When an artist gets up and plays a few notes and then go into that zone of inspiration and plays for another 5 minutes or 20 minutes, that artist is creating. And each artist on stage, the string quartet, the golden quartet, the video artist, the music that's made by the ensemble and the images shot by the video artist, all of them will be involved in this idea about creating, and they will be creating.
What conversation do you hope to start with audiences on the Southern tour of your signature work?
What does it mean to have privilege and not have privilege? That's the ultimate issue. I truly believe that instrumental music has the greatest opportunity to provoke reflection, contemplation, and meditation.
Legendary trumpeter and composer Wodada Leo Smith, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
New Quorum presents renowned trumpeter and composer Wadada Leo Smith performing his civil rights masterpiece, 10 Freedom Summers, with the Golden Quartet, Red Chorale, String Quartet, and video artist Jesse Gilbert in Loyola University's Roussel Hall, 6363 St. Charles Avenue, Saturday, 7:30 p.m. More info online at newquorum.org. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. And now we take a 360-degree turn as toilets, potty jokes, and a drought take center stage in the Tony Award-winning musical with the off-putting name Urinetown opens the season for the NOLA Project, co-produced with the University of New Orleans. We have a full house, artistic director A.J. Allegra, music director Ronald Joseph, and actors Patrick Hunter and Keith Clavery are here. Welcome.
Good to be here, Diane.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A.J., let's begin with you. Why did you choose this musical to open your season?
I think it's a very timely piece right now in terms of where we are with the climate right now. We're kind of on a kamikaze mission. We know that the global warming exists, and we're either going to do something about it or we're just going to go out with a real big bang. And here in this show, we have this horrific drought that has caused such a water shortage that toilets have become privatized and people have to pay to go to the bathroom so that the water can be conserved so that the entire planet doesn't just dry up. And it's all controlled by a greedy, megalomaniac type of millionaire villain, a real robber baron type that I think is, you know, if we look at American politics and what has happened recently, we have such leadership, you know, we have this kind of combination of this business and politics mixing in what some might deem to be unhealthy ways. And so to me, it just seemed like a really timely show. It's the political satire nature of the show that I think makes the piece so timely today.
That's incredible what you just described. Although, when I first read the plot line, I did go back to like the late 60s and early 70s when women had to pay.
Yeah. It was inspired by one of the writers who had found it absurd that he had all these pay toilets all over Europe when he was traveling in college. And he said, you know, he would sometimes literally not be able to afford to pee.
Ronald, you're the music director. It's hard for me to imagine a soundtrack to Urinetown. Can you expand on that?
Yes, the music of the show is actually very, very diverse. The opening number, there's a very Kurt Vile-ish effect to it. Going forward, there are some numbers that are very jazz-inspired. There are a couple of really high-energy song and dance numbers, and there's one that borrows from klezmer music that's very much like Fiddler on the Roof. So there's kind of a lot of diverse styles happening in the soundtrack.
So let's talk about the characters.
This is Patrick. I play Officer Lockstock, who serves a dual function in the show. Within the action of the play, he is the primary law enforcer. So he works for the big robber baron, Mr. Cladwell, who runs the show. But Officer Lockstock is his primary enforcer, who's boots on the ground among the people, making sure that nobody pees when they're not supposed to or where they're not supposed to, and making sure they're appropriately punished if they do. Secondarily, I also function as the narrator of the show, so I have the task of leading the audience through the experience, through this sort of allegorical story that we're setting up, meanwhile taking some opportunities to make a little fun of it and to point out the absurdity as well.
And Keith?
I play the character of Bobby Strong, or Babby Strong, as he's affectionately known in our production. Bobby is your everyman. He's an average guy who, at the start of the show, is having a pretty bad day. He's kind of fed up with the circumstances that he's living in and under. And, of course, the whole thing is set off by meeting a very lovely young lady who sort of teaches him that if you want to do something, you have to listen to your heart. And that's not anything he's ever been told. And then he decides to stand up for what he believes is right. He stands up to the opposition, to the institutions. But of course, as with any good story, there is an interesting relationship with the female that sort of sets things off.
Now, Patrick and Keith, do your characters connect at some point?
Yes, we have a couple of interactions. They're never exactly nice meetings. Lots of warnings are thrown out by Patrick's character to mine. There is one in particular where I am kind of closing shop at the amenity that I work at for the evening, and I get another warning. And I guess it's important to note that prior to this scene, my father has just been taken away to the infamous Urine Town, which is often discussed but never really quite understood in the show.
Out a bit late, don't you think?
Out late taking care of another late night rush is all. There's talk of more fee hikes. People are getting edgy.
Are they? Well, I'm glad to hear you were otherwise engaged. Wouldn't want to put you under suspicion for taking a late night behind the bushes.
I don't need to do that anymore, officers. Not while I work for Penny, I don't.
But you still got to keep your head out of the clouds now, don't you?
Oh, what do you mean by that?
What I mean is, you're a good boy, Bobby Strong. See that you don't end up like your father.
And how did my father end up?
Well, I'm off. My work's never done. Good night.
So you can hear in the dialogue that the style is stilted and heightened and melodramatic and all to a comic effect. And I think it's important that people do realize that this is a funny show. This is a deeply funny show. It's a tongue-in-cheek show that recognizes what it is, that comments on itself, and consistently delights the audience with heightened melodramatic dialogue about a very base subject. And I think that that is a major part of the appeal.
I run the only toilet in this part of town, you see. So if you gotta go, you gotta go through me. It's a privilege to be.
This is a show where you gotta be willing to go with anything.
NOLA Project Director A.J. Allegra, Music Director Ronald Joseph, and actors Patrick Hunter and Keith Clavery. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, man.
20 years we've had the drought, and our reservoirs have all dried out.
Urine Town, the musical, a co-production of the NOLA Project and Theater UNO, runs through October 14th in the Robert E. Nims Theater inside the Performing Arts Center on the University of New Orleans Lakefront Campus. That's our show for this week. Support for Inside the Arts comes from the Hellas Foundation. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m., and a shortened edition on Thursday mornings at 8:45, when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.